Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program, via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, February 11, 2021. Seven people are killed in Unity State Capital, Bantu.
The mission reached the destination of the cattle where the criminals were hiding this cattle. Criminals started shooting at the joint forces. And it is where we lost our dear and beloved officers.
And new Sudanese ministers vow to improve the living standards of people in Sudan.
The Sudanese people have suffered for so long from poverty in a country rich with natural resources. Over the past 18 months, the transitional government has begun some structural steps towards recovering our national economy.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Authorities in Unity State Capital, Bantu, are searching for armed young men suspected of killing seven people, including five soldiers, in Koch County this week. The governor of Unity State, Joseph Montuil, says the armed young men attacked the soldiers while they were on a mission to recover about 2,000 cattle stolen from civilians. The governor condemned the killings, saying the perpetrators must be brought to book. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Bor.
Unity State Governor Montuil says armed youth suspected of being from Koch County raided about 2,000 head of cattle from Rovkorna County on Tuesday. Governor Montuil says state officials ordered soldiers to recover the stolen cattle, and when they entered a certain area of Koch County, armed youth attacked, killing seven. He says five SSPDF soldiers were killed and 10 others were wounded during the fighting.
A mission constituted to recover raided cattle from a lake community by a criminal from the gay community. When the mission reached the destination of the cattle where the criminal were hiding this cattle, criminal started shooting at the joint forces, and it is where we lost our deer and beloved officers from the SSPDF.
Montuil condemned the killings and says the perpetrators must be brought to justice. He is urging cattle owners to remain calm as state authorities pursue the raiders.
The government would not stop from recovering this cattle, and we will pursue the criminal and we will make sure that they are brought to book, because this issue of internal kind of cattle raiding, we will not intercept it any longer. So we are going to take very tough measures against the criminals.
Governor Montuil says Unity State civilians are heavily armed and could cause more damage if not disarmed. He is calling on the national government to disarm civilians. SSPDF deputy spokesperson Santo Domic confirms the attack took place, but has yet to be officially informed about the incident.
I have not yet received any official communication about the killing of five soldiers, because there are different scenarios on that. Other sources talk less than that. Other sources reported more than this.
According to the UN mission in South Sudan, revenge attacks and cattle-related killings remain biggest insecurity challenges after political violence subsided in the country following the signing of the revitalized peace agreement in September 2018. In July last year, President Salva Kiir launched the disarmament campaign in parts of the country to try and end the cycle of violence in restive states. The campaign targets armed civilians in Lakes, Terkeka, Warap, and Jonglei states, among other areas. The disarmament exercise was later halted in Tonj following fighting that erupted between armed civilians and the disarmament forces, which left more than 100 people dead. A survey by the South Sudan Network on Small Arms last year said some communities have rejected President Kiir's conflict resolution initiative through disarmament, arguing it could leave them vulnerable to cattle raids. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Bor.
Sudan's newly appointed cabinet ministers have promised to work together and implement the objectives of their transitional government. Khalid Omar, the Minister of Cabinet Affairs, says the ministers will also work to improve security and set up a transitional justice arrangement in the country. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
Speaking shortly after taking the oath of office Wednesday evening, Cabinet Affairs Minister Khalid Omar said the appointment of the new cabinet was born out of the Juba Peace Agreement, which calls for wider political representation in the country. Omar described the new cabinet as the first diverse Sudanese political representation, saying it shows the unique diversity of the Sudanese people. He says this diversity is based on the consensus among different political parties and all other groups who believe the interest of the Sudanese citizens is the first priority. Omar says the new cabinet will work to complete political and economic reforms started by previous members of the transitional government and will focus on the economic recovery.
The Sudanese people have suffered for so long from poverty in a country rich with natural resources. Over the past 18 months, the transitional government has begun some structural steps towards recovering our national economy. It is true that these efforts have not yet been realized, but we are here to continue working on that and still consider it as one of our top priorities in the coming period.
Sudanese Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok announced his cabinet reshuffle Tuesday evening. He appointed 25 ministers, including 7 officials from the Sudanese Revolutionary Front, a coalition of armed groups which signed the peace deal with the government in October last year. Former Darfur rebel group leader Jibril Ibrahim of the Justice and Equality Movement is the new finance minister. 4 women are ministers. Omar says the transitional government will continue to engage the holdout groups in peace negotiations with the goal of achieving lasting peace and restoring security and stability across Sudan. He says Sudan cannot progress and develop a true democracy unless structural programs are fully implemented.
The aim of this transitional government is to prepare for a free and fair election at the end of this period. This transitional government is committed to see to it that different commissions are formed and enact electoral laws and engage in the constitutional making process and the constitutional conference.
Besides security sector reforms, Omar says the new government will ensure transitional justice is achieved, noting that thousands of Sudanese families are still waiting to see justice for their loved ones who were killed and injured during the revolution.
We will continue the struggle of our revolution until all its objectives are fully achieved. We will not hide anything from our citizens. We will be clear about things that we are able to do or not. The government shall maintain the highest criteria of transparency and engagement with the Sudanese people.
Isra Daoud, a resident of Halfaya neighborhood in Khartoum North, welcomes the new cabinet but says the transitional government is still incomplete. Speaking via messaging app, Daoud said there is an urgent need to form the Legislative Council which can hold the executive accountable for their deeds. Daoud said the Legislative Council is regarded as the driving force for any transitional government. It will represent all sort of Sudanese lives. 300 seats shall be divided in accordance to the geographical constituency, which will represent different social, political, and religious opinions, Daoud said. Last week, the head of Sudan's Sovereign Council, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, appointed 3 additional members from the Sudanese Revolutionary Front to the council, bringing the total number of council members to 14. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Some South Sudanese in the capital Juba are calling on the government to design a national dress code for the country. The National Minister for Culture, Museums and National Heritage says the government is still working on policies to introduce a national dress code for South Sudan. A professor at the University of Juba says, in addition to a national dress, the government should also draft ethics and manners to guide the way South Sudanese should behave. For VOA News, Dingma God reports from Juba.
Deng Aling, director and founder of Hope Society, a local organization that promotes South Sudanese art, says the lawo and jalabia are commonly worn in rural areas and some towns across South Sudan. Aling says it is important for South Sudanese to have national cultural attire.
It helps recognizing South Sudanese abroad and how also to determine or to just people once they look at it, they know that this is from South Sudan and that will make us unique. And also that will help the coming generations to also, you know, to embrace their culture and also to have a cultural consciousness.
Professor Taban Lo Leong, a South Sudanese poet and lecturer at the University of Juba, says the lawo can compete with other cultural attires across the world.
Challenge people to come in what you think is a good dress for the nation. They will tell you, let us have a lawo. Lawo for men, lawo for women, lawo for girls, which when they're still growing up, and lawo for elderly women, matronly women. Whether you are small or thin, it flows from your shoulders, like the Greek toga and the Roman toga also, for men and for women. So why not go for that?
Aside from cultural attire, Professor Lo Leong says the cultural ministry should prepare a book of manners to guide South Sudanese in their behavior towards others.
The ministry is talking about dress only on the outside. What about the man and the woman inside? The English say, manners maketh men. Men, human beings, are known for their manners. And then you know who they are because they have manners. If they have no manners, there's nothing for them to carry.
Lo Leong says that during the old days, boys and girls were initiated into adulthood and taught how to behave in society. He says that behavior and manners should also be considered part of South Sudanese identity. Nadia Arop Dudi, the National Minister for Culture, Museums and National Heritage, says she agrees it is important for South Sudan to have national attire as it helps identify South Sudan's culture.
The national wear is this one of the important symbolics to any country as a cultural aspect. And we know that even in different tribes of South Sudan, any tribes has their national traditional attire or traditional wear that they have been identified. When you see somebody, you say that this is from this tribe. Mean that it is one of our identity.
Dudi says she too supports the idea of having the lawo as the national dress for women.
Lawa is one of the attire which is very nice, and all of us, we know how to wear it, all our tribes. And some people say that, yes, it is very important also to have this as a national attire, because it's a different way that all of us, we can adapt it easily.
Dudi says the ministry is drafting a policy to provide national attire for South Sudan.
As a ministry, our role is to put the policy in place, to bring stakeholders to give us what they wanted exactly, and then the government will come and approve and send it through the cabinet and through the National Assembly so that it's become a working document or it become something that has put as a law in the country.
A national costume showcases patriotism that people often wear to funerals, birthdays, weddings, or other ceremonial events. For VOA News, I am Ding Magot in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, internet has been restored in Uganda after 1 month of blackout. Stay tuned for that story after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how can you help someone dealing with depression?
I just give my time to that person and we discuss matter concerning that depression which that person is facing.
First of all, I'll find out what is depressing that person. And when I find out the root cause, of course, I try to advise the person according to what he or she is going through.
By counseling the person through counseling and then sharing ideas. Maybe sometimes going out for football or watching football, movies, such things can also help.
I recommend music, the music therapy. Music therapy in the sense that music has a way of giving a soothing feeling whenever the person listens to music.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA health correspondent Linor Mudu. The World Health Organization and Africa Centers for Disease Control say we all can help fight the coronavirus pandemic by wearing face masks that cover our mouths and noses when we are in crowded areas. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest news on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Today is a bittersweet day for the South Sudan in Focus radio program. One of our most trusted colleagues, Ayen Deng Bior, is leaving us because she got another job at the National Public Radio here in Washington. Ayen's time with this program was characterized by her attention to details and constant curiosity about issues in our news. I have the honor to host Ayen on this program for the last time to talk about her experience coming straight from college to a newsroom.
Tanza, thank you for having me. South Sudan in Focus is, I think, the most important show at the Voice of America, and I've been really honored to work alongside you and our team for almost 6 years now, and I can't believe it's coming to a close. But, you know, I think back of my days in journalism school, and I remember wanting to join a news agency that is venerated and, you know, respected worldwide. And so when I started at VOA in May 2015, I was constantly kicking myself and pinching myself because I couldn't believe that I was working at the Voice of America. It's an agency I respect. It's an agency that my family respects. It was a huge honor for me, but I also knew that it was a huge responsibility. I was lucky enough to go to journalism school in college and study the craft. But, you know, in all honesty, I think most journalists will tell you that what you learn in school is great, but actually being on the job and being on the beat, that's where you really learn a lot. And I can definitely say that about my time with South Sudan in Focus.
Ayen, you know, I have been getting questions from people that your name sounds South Sudanese, but you don't sound South Sudanese. When did you come to the United States?
Yeah, I get that a lot, too. You know, I'll talk to people on the phone, and then when they meet me, they see that I'm South Sudanese, and they're always a bit confused. I came to the U.S. when I was really young. I was 6 or 7 years old. And coming when I was so young gave me an advantage because, you know, I really could start school at a very early age. But at the same time, I have developed this accent that confuses people. But, you know, I mean, it is what it is.
Talk to us about some of your tough times covering South Sudan. I know we all have our different experiences. Like, and I can tell you that my tough time on this program is when conflict broke out in South Sudan. What were some of your tough times?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was really tough for all of us, not just as journalists, but as South Sudanese. I mean, you know, I've told you before, like, South Sudan in Focus has covered the most complicated issues that VOA has handled throughout the years. And just the conflict in and of itself from, you know, beginning to even now, you know, is easily one of the most complicated stories in the Africa division. And I think we've done a really good job of, you know, giving people context and information. So I'm really proud of that. I think looking back, the hardest story that I've worked on was the Blue House story. And it was hard because I knew that there could be immediate and dire consequences if I didn't get the story right.
You're talking about the riot at the Blue House.
Correct. Yes. Yes, exactly. You know, I got the call
from you, actually. I believe it was a Saturday night, and I got the call from you. And obviously, the entire day, I was kind of watching Twitter and talking to people. There's a lot of confusion about what was going on. There was also a lot of fear because there was so much power, you know, around the Blue House, and there was so much uncertainty. And I spoke to a couple of my family members who said that there were tanks all over, there were guns all over, and they were, you know, just in their house, afraid. And so going into the story, I knew that we needed to do the story because there was so much uncertainty. But I knew that it needed to be done right, because if we got anything wrong, that could create further confusion. And further confusion could have dire consequences. And I remember speaking to the prisoners inside the Blue House, and I asked them over and over again, like, should I identify you? Should I identify you? Are you comfortable? You know, just making sure that they knew what they were doing by speaking to me. And, you know, each one of them said, it's really important you not only tell the world what is going on, but you use my name. Peter Biarajak actually told me, he said, no one will believe that I'm speaking to you unless you use my name. And so I used their name, and, you know, people have criticized me for doing that. But at the time, you know, I felt that, you know, collectively, you know, after getting advice from the prisoners, I knew that it was important that we named them with their permission, obviously. There's a lot that has happened since then. And I just want to be clear and say that I'm really proud of the way that, you know, we handled that story. I thought that we were incredibly careful, you know, with our facts, but also with the people that we spoke to. I was speaking to Peter Biarajak a couple of months ago. He had a press conference, and, you know, afterwards he said, you know, Ayan, I think you saved our lives that day, because you were able to tell the world exactly what was going on in the Blue House. And it was at that moment that I thought, okay, you know, I know that a lot has happened, but I am glad that we were able to get out the truth. And I'm glad that we were able to get out the truth as quickly as possible. Of all the stories that I've done with South Sudan in Focus, the Blue House riot was absolutely, in my opinion, the most important, but it was also the hardest.
Yeah, and I must add that we scooped the world on that day, because we were the only media that spoke to the detainees inside the Blue House. And thanks for doing that. Let's move on. I mean, are there any lessons that you have learned?
Oh, yeah, there's so many lessons. I could write a book about the lessons that I've learned. I think the biggest lesson, and it's a lesson that all journalists need to learn, is that we really need to take care of our mental health. The stories that we cover are incredibly difficult. And at the end of the day, I think it is important, you know, to sit down and breathe, take some time for yourself. The other lesson that I've learned is, you know, when I was starting out as a young journalist right out of college, I was intimidated by, you know, people in positions of power, be it congressmen here in Washington, or, you know, people in parliament in South Sudan. And I think I quickly realized that I cannot be intimidated by them, and that it is my job to hold them accountable. That is something that took me a few months to learn, but that I think is an incredibly important lesson for me.
And, you know, my lessons on this program is, you know, that a lot of people in South Sudan take truth-telling synonymous to rebellion. I mean, I've been called names by the government, by the opposition, by the SPLM-IO, just because I speak the truth to power. Have you been called names by South Sudanese leaders?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I have, you know, and I mean, I think for me, if people in positions of power are your friends, then you're not doing your job right. If people in positions of power, you know, are not criticizing you, then you're not doing your job right, because it is your job to hold them to the fire and get them to admit things that they would rather stay in the dark. And that's very uncomfortable for them. And because of that, you know, they want somebody to blame. And that person will be the journalist who's just trying to do their jobs. So it's unfortunate, but, you know, I think at this point it's just part of the job. what we both know is that we don't take it personally, and we just continue to do our jobs to the best of our ability.
And again, a final question here. I know that a lot of female South Sudanese journalists, if you like, aspiring to be Ayen Deng Bior. What would be your advice to South Sudanese journalists who think that it is not easy to, go international?
Well, the first thing that I would tell them is, don't try to be like a Ayen Deng Bior. Try to be better than me. And I could write a whole book about this. I'm really passionate about giving advice to young female journalists. I think the one thing that I would tell young women who are trying to either break into journalism or who are trying to make a name for themselves in the journalism world is know your worth and don't let anyone tell you that, you're not as good as you are. Also, own your work. When you do a great story, own it. Put your name on it. Let the world know that you did that story. I think this is something that men do really well. When they do a story, they are not afraid to let people know that it is their name on that byline. I think women sometimes have a sense of, being a little shy. And I don't think that really helps anyone. This is a lesson that has taken me a really long time, but I think it's really important.
That's my colleague Ayen Deng Bior talking about her experiences covering South Sudan.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
We love to hear what you think about this show. Send us brief comments on issues in our news or what is happening in your area. Our WhatsApp number is +1 202 630 8011. We'll air your comments every Friday. That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Peer Aher.
Jabu jamme jamma ngwilera wo da baba ben beye keda pir akornum pir akormat wan ku pirchu ko mit ke bay sudan mel ku ne piro kaneng ka korke piro kaneng mike ne piraer wo kai kol chuñ wey banru jangru wo tu wey ndugo kai bako ke dwaleben jangru jangru akola panda birawe jangru jangru ben jambo mit ke sausu jangru jangru wo luñ wey ndugo jangru jangru wo kai kot ke bay ci dung banru jangru ku yak pingu yak jam ngenge jam yak jam we dorur yone panduk aci ndoru ku ne ray mi ke ding dug mat ke jeng ben ben biya ban moy takwa daka ci njuru war wo niye pinyi no ma ci njuru war wo rel pewo to panda ke ni wo adana ka nga do bay ci ngegem wo
We've been listening to D Court with the song Peer Aher. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for taking time to listen to this show. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you are in public places. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Ik koy dum ti jaddem ken kawa awany pan be yangiran yin
denguru denguru
Wukai kol chilun way.
Wangru dengru.
What the way in yendugo.
Dengru dengru.
Kai bako kedwa leven.
Dengru dengru.
Akola panda birawin. Dengru.